that there's all sorts of things that my research touches on that are of very very much relevant and of interest to you. But I would also guess that what you'll find is that I touch on it. I don't necessarily access the full breadth or depth of research related to water issues that could be relevant to what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to ask that you stay with me on this. I'm coming at this from a different perspective. And when I do touch on something like that, I hope that you'll see that perhaps it's a research opportunity for people with more background in water issues to get involved in things related to life cycle assessment. Now, I'm going to talk about the method of life cycle assessment. I'm going to talk about carbon footprinting. I'm going to talk about water footprinting. And I'm also going to talk about some work that I've done on estimating the greenhouse gas emissions associated with water use. And I hope that you find this interesting and that you find some opportunities for additional things to consider. Okay, so what's the life cycle? Life cycle assessment tries to go from cradle to cradle. We actually used to call it cradle to grave, but then somebody sort of recognized that, well, that's not a cycle. If we want a cycle, we've got to think about bringing things back to where they started. So this is a pretty typical picture of a life cycle. It's something that I've used for many, many years. And I turned the box in the middle yellow. So the box in the middle yellow, that's me. I worked as a design engineer. I produced cars for General Motors. Sometimes I think that this is my penance to make up for that. And when I produced cars, I specified the materials that would be used and how it would be used, which ultimately affected the fuel use in the car. And what I did was from a life cycle perspective, I was looking upstream. Where am I getting my materials from? Are they recovered materials? Are they durable materials so that I don't have to remake parts of the car quite frequently? I can also look downstream as far as how what I design is used. So I'm designing this car. It's having a life of, we usually use an estimate of 17 years, which includes the first person that owns it and then the next person that owns it. And it burns gasoline the entire time over that life before we hopefully throw it away. Sorry, that came out completely wrong. Before we hopefully recycle it. And in fact, cars are very highly recycled. People from the auto industry will tell you that 95% or upwards of 95% of vehicles are recycled. What they mean by that is by mass, and it's the steel. So the whole life cycle is looking upstream to see where your resources are coming from and hopefully making good decisions about what you're using. And looking downstream as far as thinking about how your product might be used and how you might create opportunities as a designer to actually recycle things and reuse things and recover products. So essentially with this picture, this cradle-to-cradle picture, what we're trying to do is understand that there's a whole set of disciplines that are making decisions throughout the life cycle. And there's a whole set of implications based on all of those decisions and how they work together. And these implications are environmental, they're economic, and they're social, just like that sustainability thing. And the idea of looking at that cradle-to-cradle picture is so that you can avoid unintended consequences. So let's look at an example. Years ago, people thought it would be a really, really good idea to add lead to gasoline. Who thought this? Who in here ever wondered, why do they call gasoline unleaded? It's because of this. Years ago, they thought if they added lead to gasoline, it would actually make the car engines operate better. Which sounded great, but lead comes in, lead goes out into the air, everybody breathe in. Lead levels in people's blood rose dramatically, and we had a real, real problem. We got the lead out of the gasoline, which was great. And sort of the success part of this story is that once they got the lead out of the gasoline, they started to look at other sources of lead pollution, which was kind of good. So they started to get lead out of paint. Lead was added to paint to make it more durable. But when you paint your house with lead, it rains, the soil all around your house full of lead. Little kids playing in the dirt, little kids get exposed to lead. Battery recycling, lead acid batteries. We use a lot of them, and we're starting to use them differently. They are actually recycled at a very, very high rate, which there's bad aspects to lead acid batteries, but there's one that sort of is better than the alternative. So hopefully from what we might learn from something like this is that if we take this bigger picture of what we're changing about a system and looked at the what implications might occur using something like a cradle-to-cradle view, then we might make better decisions in the first place. So did we learn from this? I'm going to go with no. Very recently, we thought it would be a great idea to add MTBE to gasoline to reduce the carbon monoxide emissions coming out of the tailpipe. If you think about this from a life cycle perspective, you think about the fuel and how the fuel is transported so that it gets to the gas station so people can put it in their cars. Well, apparently, when they put MTBE in with the gasoline, it makes the gasoline tend to leak more out of underground storage tanks. It's a different chemical property between gasoline with MTBE and gasoline without. So in this particular case, what we have done is we have traded air pollution for water pollution. And since I'm in the water seminar, I would want to think that you think that that's not okay. So what we're trying to do is take this cradle to cradle to view to hopefully be able to anticipate some of the unintended implications that might occur associated with a large scale or even a small scale technology change. So, life cycle assessment is a method. It's been standardized by the International Standards Organization, the ISO, under the 14,000 series. The protocol is intended to extend from cradle to cradle. And it basically provides a way for you to scope out your quantitative assessment, have you be able to estimate the materials and energy use and the emissions, and with materials and energy use, that's water too, and the emissions throughout that cradle-to-cradle set of processes. And impact assessment is supposed to tell us what that means. Are we contributing to climate change? Are we contributing to acidification? Are we eutrophying things? What is it that we're doing by emitting all of these things throughout the life cycle? And then interpretation is intended to be good research. It's sensitivity analysis. It's uncertainty analysis. It's looking at your data and looking at how you put your model together and seeing if you think that two things are actually different or if there's one piece of really, really bad data that's driving your entire conclusion that you might go back and seek better information for. And life cycle assessment has been used in product development, in research and development, in strategic planning, marketing, and public policy. And of late, it seems that everybody is interested in life cycle assessment. The gentleman who was bagging my groceries was talking to me about corn ethanol and the amount of energy it took to make it. I've been doing this since, mid-1990s. That was amazing. Life cycle assessment is really of interest in a very, very wide scale right now. So, all right, just very typically, I use this all the time. What does the life cycle of a coffee maker look like? And the reason that I pick a coffee maker is it because most people in here will be familiar. And it touches a whole lot of sectors of the economy. So we're starting out with the production of coffee beans. What do we know about coffee bean production? Well, it can be shade coffee. It can be coffee that considers labor practices in different parts of the world. What do we know about paper production? Why is it again that we have to have bright white coffee filters? I'm just not sure. Why do they have to be paper? Couldn't they be some other material? And Let's suppose, for example, that I make it out of metal mesh. Over the life of the coffee maker, I have two different things going on. I have a paper filter that I'm going to put in the garbage, so I'm creating solid waste, or I'm creating compost, which has methane emissions or other kinds of emissions that are associated with composting, or I'm using more water to wash my filter every day. So it's a trade-off. I've got plastic, I've got metals, so I've got mining, I've got glass production, I've got the use of water during the use of the coffee maker, and I've got the consumption of electricity for however long it is that your coffee maker lasts. So I like this because, again, it does touch on a number of sectors, and it shows you that, again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to estimate the energy and materials use and waste throughout the life cycle. So I'm going to understand coffee production, and I'm going to understand paper production, and plastic production, and aluminum production to be able to understand what's going on with a coffee maker. All right, now, let's have some legendary examples. I mentioned the gentleman at the grocery store who wasn't actually talking to me about paper versus plastic, but that's where a lot of this started. Paper versus plastic, which is better? For years, it was paper uses more water and solid waste, and plastic uses more energy. Then for a while, it was the better choice is whichever you can recycle in the place that you live. And now, what's the answer? It's the fabric bags that we're going to bring to the store. Diapers, reusable versus disposable. And that was a very interesting debate. And in the end, there was a life cycle assessment that was done that shined right in and said, for the health of your child, disposable or better. It went into, in particular, some of the aspects of cleanliness associated with the different kinds of diapers. So I'm a parent. That's going to sway me. And I'm going to turn over the study and see who wrote it. Procter & Gamble, come on. And there's a lot of this still going on, greenwashing. So that was greenwashing from years ago. Using life cycle assessment, we've still got this going on. So grocery bags, diapers, coffee cups, are we washing them or are we throwing them away? We're composting in a wide scale here at the University of Washington, although I don't think it's wide scale beyond the University of Washington. But more recently, we're seeing things like bottled water. What's wrong with the tap? Hydrogen production. People were looking at fuel cell vehicles. I did a tremendous amount of research about 8 or 9 years ago in the production of fuel cells. It was a continually underlying question. Where is the hydrogen going to come from? People talk about fuel cell vehicles as having no emissions. It actually emits water. But the emissions are all in the upstream production of that hydrogen and the construction of the infrastructure to deliver that hydrogen to people. And then more recently, ethanol, and I'll talk a little bit more about that today as far as how much energy it takes to make ethanol as a fuel as opposed to how much it produces. And actually, since I'm mentioning it right now, situation was a very interesting story from the researcher's standpoint, because there was one study that came out of Cornell University by Pimentel that said that corn ethanol takes more energy produced than it provides as fuel. Front page, all over the place. You guys have all heard it, haven't you? Did you see the retractions? Because I don't think they were on the front page. Pimentel still thinks that there was a lot of good aspects, and I think everybody thinks that there was a lot of really good aspects to the work that he did, but there was older data involved. There were assumptions that maybe weren't exactly as sure as they might have been to be able to draw that conclusion. And I have friends that have spent the last many years refuting that study. So, front page, and then the additional information maybe not making it into the mainstream. That seems to be something that we're seeing more and more of within the context of life cycle assessment. And in part, maybe it's because the methods and the data are actually kind of complicated there's a lot of information. And so that there's definitely been a push to make the method and the results more accessible to people. All right, so in all of these cases, which is best? It usually depends. There's rarely 100% certainty, but in all of your research activities, how often is there 100% certainty? It depends on where you live, what time of year it is, what you consider the most important. See, and something that's an eco indicator. It's what is an eco indicator? It captures all environmental impact associated with everything. Well, how can that be? When you see something that says it's just better for the environment, you should ask, on the basis of what? Is it on the basis of resource renewability, water use, emissions? What is it on the basis of? Because to be able to make a definitive statement, either everything has to be better about this new thing, which can be possible if you're just, you know, eliminating stuff. That could be good. Could be, depending on if people respond by replacing what you're getting rid of with something else. But really, really question. If somebody says something is better for the environment, ask. On the basis of what? So unfortunately, here we have this mathematical method that is really, really popular that gives us the answer, it depends. A little bit unsatisfying. Okay, so life cycle assessment, what does it estimate? It estimates information in the broad categories of sustainability. Usually it estimates environmental impacts, energy consumption, contribution to climate change, acidification, toxic impacts. If you only look at climate change, you're doing a carbon footprint. If you only look at climate change, aren't you sort of missing the spirit of life cycle assessment in trying to avoid unintended consequences? Aren't you completely ignoring what's going on with water? Well, why don't we do a water footprint? We do a water footprint and only look at water. Are we still missing the spirit of trying to have a comprehensive assessment that allows us to understand what some of the unintended consequences might be? So that's still a question, and it's something that I think that as researchers and as a community, we're grappling with, because every time I add an interest in some new impact, I add a whole lot of calculations on my end. And every time I add a whole lot of calculations on my end, I give more results to people who wanted more simple results in the first place. So it can be really challenging. But in addition to life cycle impact or environmental impacts, because we're taking this very broad view of the system, this cradle-to-cradle view, you can think about social impacts or economic impacts. Economic impacts. If my life cycle is particularly sensitive to the price of fuel, or the price of natural gas, or the price, or like a price of specific fuel, and that price goes up, then I might be able to expect that the price of my operations would go up, and that can be good information. What about job creation? Green jobs, but people are interested. Look at our economy, we're interested in job creation. We can get a better understanding of where we're gonna gain and lose jobs when we disseminate new technologies. But what I wanna focus on going forward is some more about the details of how life cycle assessment is performed and how it relates to water. So in the method itself, really at the center is this inventory analysis where we're estimating how much energy and how much emissions, and the impact assessment where we're trying to figure out, given those, that energy and resource use and those emissions, what the impact is going to be. So what I want you to take away is that there's three types of life cycle assessment inventory. So that's how I'm gonna account for how much energy and how much resource use and how much waste. There's economic input-output analyses, and there's process-based analyses that are attributional or consequential, and I'm going to tell you about them all. I'm going to start with a tool that's on the web for free. You can go and play with it today. It's by my very good friends at Carnegie Mellon. It was mentioned in the most recent Super Freakonomics book, talking about this type of life cycle inventory analysis. Now, this is what this does. Essentially what it does is it recognizes that each sector in the economy uses energy and uses resource and creates pollution. And they also trade between each other. So somebody in the construction industry buys something from the agricultural industry, and when they buy something, they have a dollar amount that they're buying. And if you take the agricultural industry's total environmental impact and divide it by the value of the products that they produce, then you can have it go to your product. So what we're doing is we're estimating what they're calling the life cycle environmental impacts as a function of the economic interactions that sectors have throughout the economy. And you can go today and go to this tool and get an estimation of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with using steel, or using aluminum, or using products from the chemicals industry. So advantages is that everybody can use it. People have been screaming, give us the data. Here it is in this particular format. Some of the challenges are that the data are aggregated by sector. So the chemicals sector is actually only two different things. It's either organic or inorganic. Come on, we know there's a little bit more differentiation between chemicals than that. And metals are essentially steel and non-ferrous, steel, aluminum, and other non-ferrous. So big aggregations of data. However, the data are quick, the data are available, and the data are very transparent. Now, recently, my friends at Carnegie Mellon came out with a water study. Very recently. It came across my desk like months ago, I think. They essentially assigned water use to all the sectors of the environment, and then what they did was same kind of thing. I'm in the construction industry, I'm using materials from the agricultural industry and from the automotive industry. How much water am I using, and how much water is being used to produce all of the things that I use? And apparently power generation came out the loser. They have estimates for other sectors of the economy as well, something that you might want to go ahead and look at. One of the things you want to notice is beside the high level of aggregation, the data are based on the economic structure of the U.S. in 2002. Has the economy changed since 2002? We'll go with yes. So things are changing now. Demand for water is different than it was in 2002. And so although this is publicly available, easy to use, you can go do it right now, there are some challenges with how this information can be used and whether or not you can make it do what it is that you want to do. Now, the type of research that I do is different. Instead of using these pictures of the economy, I model individual industrial processes. So I figure out how much irrigation water is used at farm and how much energy is used for that irrigation. So I'm making more of an engineering connection between the processes throughout my life cycle. What I think is that means that I can also differentiate between technologies in a way that they can't. I can say, gee, if you use this newfangled irrigation system, you're going to have a different greenhouse gas profile than you would if you used some other method. Or if you have this particular type of crop that you want to grow in one part of the country, it's going to be different than if you grow it in another. So my method, a lot more information is needed, a lot more understanding of industrial processes needed, but different uses, different advantages to being able to use this method. So for this process-based life cycle assessment, the vast majority of what's been done in life cycle assessment is process-based attributional. That means that when they do the life cycle inventory analysis, they assume everything is average, okay? So the U.S. electricity grid has an average mix of coal and natural gas and oil and hydro. And is that the same mix as we have here? No, it's not. And hydro is always good to talk about because, as you know, it has no greenhouse gas emissions and therefore no impact. Doesn't anybody else care about some of the other impacts besides the folks that are here? But if you think about it, people are really focused on greenhouse gas emissions, and hydro ends up looking like it has no impact. So that can be, well, and nuclear comes out pretty good as well. But although there's been some more recognition more recently that there's other greenhouse gas emissions associated with a lot of the storage. All right, so everything is on average. Average performance of all technologies and average technology application when you're doing an attributional life cycle assessment. More recently, what people have said is that, you know, if we disseminate a technology really widely, things are going to change. It's not going to be business as usual. It's not going to be business as average. Things are going to change. And if things change, then the environmental impact could change. So a consequential life cycle assessment tries to understand change, like technological responses by the market. Okay, what if I grow a whole bunch more a feedstock for biofuels, and I increase the demand for water? What's going to happen? Is everything going to stay on average? Is everything going to be like the 2002 economy in response to a new water demand? I don't think so. So consequential life cycle assessment is struggling to understand the future. I can't tell the future. Let's talk about that for a second. Okay, so let's put this into context first. What am I talking about? I'm talking about food versus fuel. Okay, you guys have heard this. If I grow a bunch of biofuel on land that I used to make food on, then supposedly the food market has to respond. I've decreased the supply of food. Theoretically, somewhere else in the world, somebody else has to make food. Now, interestingly, according to the EPA and several researchers throughout the world, if I reduce the supply of corn, the food market doesn't necessarily respond with corn. I did not know this until somewhat recently, within the last couple of years. Instead of corn, apparently the food response is going to be some corn, some rice, some livestock. So there's a very, very different response to this change in the food market, and livestock production is really, really greenhouse gas intensive. It just has different emissions than the corn in the first place. So life cycle assessment or consequential life cycle assessment is going to try to understand some of these changes. All right, now, early on, the methodology of consequential life cycle assessment. Early writings were 1999, 2003. Essentially what they said was that you should take this model of what it is that you're going to disseminate, figure out what resources it's using and what resources it's producing, because sometimes we produce a bunch of byproducts and flood the market. For example, if you know anything about biofuels, we've got a glycerol glut. Glycerol is a byproduct of some of the conversion processes associated with oils that are used for fuel production. And in a life cycle assessment, you might want to find a use for that glycerol, but there's more glycerol in the market than the market wants. So if you're going to assume that it's going to have this wonderful use, you might be disappointed to find that that wonderful use is putting it in a landfill. These early writings suggested that for consequential, what we want to do is we want to have a method so that we can pick the technology that's going to be affected by our new system. And more recently, people were like, well, that puts an awful lot of faith in your ability to tell the future, that it's going to be one technology that comes in and replaces this change in supply or demand in the market. So what people have been saying is, okay, well, if we can't pick one, because we can't tell the future, then let's model a variety of responses and sort of see what the range is. Because as we're putting together sort of a strategy for dissemination of new products, we could, if we understand what the ranges are, then maybe we could design it in such a way that we avoid the bad stuff. That sounds pretty good. All right, so I want you to consider for a second our recent work on algae feedstock for fuel. Have you heard about this in the news? It's been wonderfully interesting to work on algae fuels for the Air Force over the last couple of years. So we came up with this model of energy and resource use and waste for growing the algae, for extracting the oil from the algae and making it into jet fuel. And we had a very, very good understanding of what resources we were using, what we were throwing away. And so then what we wanted to do was model the possible market responses and a variety of them so we could test what was the maximum and minimum. This is what I came up with. You're not supposed to be able to read this. The point here is that there's so many market responses, and having an understanding of what the range of them is complicated, but actually it can tell you things that you wouldn't have found out by looking at these analyses for things on average. And so that actually inspired us, because after we did all of this work to estimate the energy and materials use and waste for everything that's listed on here, we actually found something out that we were pleased to find out about this particular system. Okay, so we did. We modeled all of this. And then what we did was we presented the results as max and min. Okay, now, what we found out, now attributional, this is the assessment on average, and then I've got the minimum consequential LCA and the maximum consequential LCA. See the maximum? That's water. What that is in growing algae, all right, so the US Air Force and Boeing comes to us and they said, algae is great. We can grow algae on unproductive land. Okay, we can grow it in the middle of the desert. And this entire ongoing discussion about changing from food to fuel goes away, because we're going to use unproductive land. So we don't have to get into the food versus fuel argument. We're just going to grow it in the middle of the desert. Is there water in the middle of the desert? Do you need water to grow algae? We thought so. So you're going to have to ship it in. All right? From unproductive land, we don't have to deal with all the people that are arguing about what the economic response is by the food industry. So now we've got a water problem. And what we found was, we said, okay, now remember, this is the extreme results. Do we think the extreme is going to happen? No. But we wanted to find out what we could find out about this system. So this extreme result right here, that's based on this logic of saying, okay, well, in the United States, there's an increasing demand for water, right? And one of the things that's telling us something about that increasing demand for water is construction starts, right, of desalination plants, okay? Guess what? We're building desalination plants, okay? Do you know how much energy it takes to desalinate water? Oh my gosh, a lot. So, if the greenhouse gas emissions associated with indirect water use for the production of algae in the middle of the desert considers the energy use in desalinating water. It told us that. All right, now, what does that mean? I don't want to go to the Air Force and say, well, I want to go to the Air Force and tell them what we found, but I'd also like to hopefully come up with something that I can tell them beyond that. So this is what we told them. There's a zillion species of algae. Choose one that doesn't grow on fresh water. Choose one that grows on saline water. Ooh, better yet, choose one that grows on wastewater. Because algae need nutrients to grow, and the US EPA just, you guys know this better than me, but I'm gonna try it. They're lowering the water discharge standards into streams. They're requiring, what is it, nitrogen or phosphorus that they have to get more out. Better way to ask the question, is it nitrogen or phosphorus that's going to be the hardest for wastewater treatment to get out? Because we have to get rid of additional nitrogen. Okay, so the algae are going to eat it. Now, it's not a perfect balance. The typical wastewater has, I'm going to get this wrong, has more of one of the other. So you're going to have to supplement one of the two. But that's okay. Because In the supplementation process, there's a gentleman, David Stenzel, in the Environmental Engineering Department, who has a byproduct that we can make, which is to be used as a really high-end fertilizer. We'll talk about fertilizer again in a second. So I liked this because I could go to the U.S. Air Force and I could go to Boeing and I could say, that desalination thing, I think it's real. It's a real problem that we want to consider. We do not want to be creating more and more biofuels that create more and more demand for water. So how about saline species? How about wastewater species? How about we use life cycle assessment to look at more options on how we can really smartly get out of this fuel problem that we're in? All right, so inventory analysis, you can do EIOLCA, so that's the sectors, interactions of the sectors in the economy. You can do process LCA on average, or you can make a big old mess of the market like we did and see if you can have some sort of indication of what the max and min responses by the market might be for a new technology dissemination. Given any of those, what you want to do next is estimate impact assessment. And I'm a little nervous about talking to you guys about this because I do most of my work in inventory analysis. And in impact assessment, I think that there's a lot of opportunity for research. But the way that the method goes, the first thing that you do is you take all of the resource use and waste in your life cycle and you categorize it. These 7 contribute to climate change. These 4 contribute to eutrophication. And then what you want to do is you want to characterize the contribution of those in each class to each particular impact. So in case anybody's keeping track, we are double counting, okay? If I have a whole long list and there's a particular VOC that contributes to smog and to toxic impacts, it gets to be counted in both places, just so that you know. Okay, characterization is going to tell us or help us understand what the contribution is going to be. So in general, characterization factors are trying to consider fate and transport and exposure assessment and dose response. And you can kind of, those are terms that are used in health, but you can think about it in other kinds of modeling too. So fate and transport, if there's a chemical that's degrading in the water, then it's likelihood of being able to actually cause an impact goes down as opposed to something that stays around forever, theoretically. And depending on how the water's moving and the temperatures and differences between the media, the environment. Okay, so vast bodies of research are needed and smaller have been applied in understanding how to compare chemicals for life cycle assessment. Most of the work's been done in climate change, okay? So I just thought for a minute I'd talk just a teeny tiny bit about climate change. Okay, now, most of the work has been done in climate change. I just said that. And there's an incredible amount of uncertainty in the work that's been going on related to climate change. And since 1994, the IPCC has published different versions of how chemicals compare within the context of climate change. I would argue that this is where we have the most research going on and that the best this is where we have the best understanding of impact. And look, it's changing. So what we want to do is we want to hopefully have people doing good research in the area of impact assessment. And some of this research has been coming out of Europe. And some of this information has been coming out of Europe for some time, which means that some of it's old, and a lot of it is based on European conditions, not global conditions, not U.S. conditions. So the vast amount of impact assessment research for life cycle assessment is Eurocentric. There is an opportunity for additional research associated with our region, with the United States, and I hope that there's people in this room that might be interested in that kind of assessment. All right, what about water footprinting? I don't know a lot about water footprinting. Apparently, I know some things about water in the systems that I'm looking at. But water footprinting is really much, much newer than carbon footprinting. So water footprinting is trying to look at three different types of water, green water, which is the volume of rainwater evaporated, blue water, which is the volume of surface or groundwater evaporated, and gray water, which is the volume of polluted water. And honestly, the gray water is the one that, because of my experience in industrial processes and pollution prevention, that seems to make the most sense to me, but I understand that there's been the least research done in this area. So what the polluted water does is that if you have an industrial plant or an agricultural facility that has runoff, it's the amount of water that's needed to dilute that runoff to get it to the water quality standards of that particular region. I am not a water, I invite you to look more into water footprinting. It is not an area that I have done research in. It is an area that's, it's becoming as popular as the rest of life cycle assessment, and it's moving towards having the same kind of big front page, maybe not as much understanding of the data behind it as possible. So here, let's proliferate that. The waterfootprint.org. I didn't look at the analyses. I don't know how well they were put together. But they apparently told us that it takes 2,400 liters to make a hamburger. That sounds like a lot of water for one hamburger. And what they're doing is a life cycle assessment. They're considering the production of the bun. Okay, they're considering the packaging of the bun and the sending of the bun to McDonald's. They're considering the growing of the cows, which cows are registered on everybody's greenhouse gas inventories. But apparently they use a lot of water as well. They're considering the vegetables as well. Maybe a little mayo on the side. Okay, the same PowerPoint presentation showed water footprints for a range of fuels, bioethanol and biofuels, and I put a little arrow where the hamburger fits. So the graph on the bottom is for liters of fuel, and the arrow shows you where the hamburger fits. So there's a number of fuels that we can get a liter of, which, by the way, bioethanol should be comparable. Biodiesel, the fuel value is going to be different than the ethanol. So it's actually a graph that you might cut off from here on. But here, you can have a hamburger or you can have sugar beet fuel. So what I want you to take away from this, though, is that there's less data than for climate change, and I think that there's been less critique of the water footprinting methodology, and I think people like you could be really helpful in this respect. Completing your impact assessment, essentially what you want to do is try to put it into context. Am I disseminating this large-scale technology, and is it's increasing the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the technology that I was using before by 3,000%, but the technology that I was using before was only 1/1,000,000th of what goes on in the U.S. So it's trying to put it into context about you might be improving things by vast percentages, but if it's not contributing a lot, you want to have that context as well. And then valuation is, if you've got water impacts and you've got climate change impacts and you've got toxic impacts, if you want to make one decision, just multi-attribute utility theory, it's just analytical hierarchy process, it's just decision theory that says that you have to decide which among them are the most important unless they are all telling you the same thing. And you would need that to sort of conclude at the end and come up with a final decision. Okay, so here's my wrapping up. Water footprinting, carbon footprinting. What about phosphorus footprint? We are running out of phosphorus, and we are just, it's a dissipative use the way we are right now. We need to start capturing our phosphorus and using it back again. And it's becoming more and more expensive, and I think you're gonna see a lot more phosphorus footprints. And you can, the obvious water system implications there. New trend in life cycle assessment is looking at market consequences, and please remember that life cycle assessment is fundamentally interdisciplinary, so to do good water studies, I need your help because I am not a water person. Very wide range of folks are getting involved in life cycle assessment, and one of the things that I wanted to end on life cycle assessment very, very typically does not include the estimation of releases due to accidents. And I looked up BP. like maybe many of you had, but I looked it up and I wanted to see if they had applied LCA. Just for me. And they did. They have a new plastics recycling process they have applied LCA to, and they've been using the life cycle assessment results to promote and to market this plastic. And I really enjoyed being here. Does anybody have any questions? Within the last year has put a tremendous amount of money into research on algae. And when they put out an RFP, they say, give me research on algae. And people respond, and a lot of the people responded with freshwater species. And I think our results told us something that we didn't before. And I don't think it was apparent before. So they didn't know. It does. So when we got the results, I was like, okay, I can totally understand that, but I honestly wouldn't have thought of it when we started. Okay? So now, looking through that lens, I can't believe we hadn't thought of it in the first place. So I was encouraged by the method that we used to tell us something that we needed to be able to concretely defend.
All right. Thanks, Joyce.